I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The Northern California 9/11 Truthers put on an event this past September 11th to mark the 11th anniversary. And today you're going to hear two of the speeches from that event. The first one is Mickey Huff, who runs Project Censored. And the second one is Peter Phillips, who is the director of the Media Freedom Foundation. Google Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation, and you'll get to their websites and read about the many shocking stories being censored by the corporate media. You'll also get to see their book, Project Censored 2013, that just came out this month. Both of these gentlemen are university professors. So first, let's begin with Mickey Huff.
I'd like to thank everybody here that's now clapping for everybody else, because you're the ones that are also showing us, each other, and anybody else that there are people that really do care in America about things of great import. I would not only like to recognize today as the 11th anniversary of the events of September the 11th, 2001, I'd like to remember all of the victims of imperialism and globalist greed throughout the centuries, not just on the 9/11s from New York or Chile. 35,000 people a day starve to death. We need to have more wars, maybe that are based on constructive compassion, to help alleviate the world's problems, not destroy people and the earth in the process. I'd like to speak tonight also then about, given that this is the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, I'd like to talk about the process of anniversary. And Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored, and Dr. Paul Ray, with whom I've worked on sections of the upcoming book, Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution, which will be out next month from Seven Stories Press, and Peter Phillips, of course, whom we'll be speaking here very shortly. We've really been tackling these issues in our new work, these anniversaries, this concept of unhistory. Noam Chomsky, not long ago, was writing about this phenomenon of unhistory, and I'm a professor of history, and I really focus a lot of time on these unhistories, meaning the histories that are supported by factual evidence but don't seem to make it into the history books, right? We're familiar with Howard Zinn and James Loewen and Francis Fitzgerald and many, many, many others over the years that have helped bring these vernacular narratives and counter-narratives to light that are really based on factual evidence, but they get suppressed through the process of officializing narratives, narratives based on mythologies, not factual realities. And as you all know here, the events of 9/11 really kind of fit into a whole stream of mythic narratives that get blurred, obfuscated, distorted, converted into Hallmark postcards and bumper stickers and used as means to raise money to further empire. And this is, again, a process that needs extraordinarily deconstructed. Michael Peretti, another progressive leftist historian, wrote in a work called History is Mystery, "Those engaged in the manufacturing of history often introduce distortions at the point of origin, well before history is written or even played out. This initial process of control is not usually left to chance, but is regularly pursued by interested parties who are situated to manipulate the record." William Casey, director of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1981, stated, leaving an early meeting with Reagan and his cabinet, quote, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American people believe is false." Are we there yet? For several years now, we at Project Censored have been describing the Americans' general lack of awareness about what's going on in the country and the world as a literal and ongoing truth emergency. It is a state of psychic numbing and information overload, one which results from the ubiquitous din of establishment propaganda and top-down managed news. These are very specific terms that I'm using for a reason. Many Americans don't know what they don't know, and many can't discern between what is real and manufactured. Still others show little interest outside their daily lives. Although our culture is awash in information, many citizens often lack an adequate understanding of what that information really means because the institutions that disseminate this information, particularly the news media, I'd like to make a correction from Barry Zwicker, with all due respect. It is not the mainstream media. It is the corporate media. It is the megaphone of the 1%. It is the mechanism of thought control in our society that is most ubiquitously used. And it is a great achievement of corporate propaganda that we say mainstream media because we're the mainstream, not the corporate media. So stop saying mainstream media unless you're talking about your media. We gotta watch how we talk. We have to watch the words we use because they have meaning, and we all slide into these meanings, and we all need to make friendly nudges to each other when we are found using the terms that come from the ruling class to describe our own lives. We need to have our own vernacular narratives and reclaim these narratives for the common good. The only way we can do that is by working together and being mutually respectful. And I am saying this with all due respect to Barry or any others whom I have said this to. It is not a negative critique. It is a reminder to us that we are the 99% and the mainstream, and we have to really make our voices heard. As I was saying, if journalism then is this rough draft of history, then we are really in for a rude awakening because these rough drafts are not always accurate. And whether it's because journalistic deadlines or ignorance of an issue or fear of offending a source or an advertiser or an owner of a major media outlet, there's many possible reasons that rough drafts are not always accurate, for they tend to become narratives and maintenance of the established order rather than factually inclusive reports about a complex and diverse world. In the United States, culturally conditioned assumptions like exceptionalism, mythic narratives of exceptionalism, or the belief in the country's unique moral mission are very powerful and pervasive, and they further bolster these establishment views, which in turn maintain order and reinforce hierarchy and oppression. They represent an underlying bias. This is what America is and is not. This is what America does and does not do. Thus, historical mythic narratives are a significant part of educational and media institutions in the United States, and they frame our perception. Let's go back to William Casey's quote from the CIA. Much of the information we receive comes from mass media and institutions of education, all of which are subject to some degree of government oversight and control, as well as clearly from the private sector. The leading public institutions of our society, the government, the mass media, the educational institutions, are increasingly influenced or outright owned by extremely wealthy transnational corporations that have vested interests in returns on venture capital, not democracy, and have very little interest in factual reality or truth. These interests adhere to the bottom line first and foremost, and these are the reasons we need to call them out for that bias. Michael Parenti has talked also about the stacked deck of history as a political scientist. He argues that history is not just what historians say it is, but what government agencies, corporate publishing conglomerates, chain store distributors, mass media pundits, editors, reviewers, and other ideological gatekeepers want to put into circulation. Not surprisingly, the deck is stacked in favor of those who deal the cards. One must then ask, how might those dealing the cards influence the reporting of news? One way is by framing or controlling what is considered legitimate information and what is not, i.e. what makes the news and what's on the test in school, solely on the basis of what the dealers say it is without question. Any official account of the past not only impact perception in the present, but also consistently crowd out vernacular views, often rendering them obscure and illegitimate, thus part of a pile of unhistory. George Orwell wrote about the unperson, the person that did not conform to the state propaganda and rule. The unhistory is the history that defies the dominant state corporatist narrative. The events of 9/11 fit into that category. There are many facts of 9/11 that defy the official narrative, which is why they find themselves on the margins or the outside of even allegedly intellectual culture. What we need to do as citizens of a purportedly free society is simply demand that those narratives are present, and events like this remind us that they are part of the public sphere. I think this is a very, very important thing that we all collectively need to remember. Uncritical acceptance of any official narrative is the result of conventional education, past reporting. This can all shade interpretations of the present. Noam Chomsky also has referred to this as the necessary illusions of our democracy. And I'm well aware that people in 9/11 research circles have their issues with people like Chomsky or Amy Goodman or Michael Parenti or other figures on the left. And oft it's because some of characters on the left have been loath to apply their own standards of critical judgment to themselves when addressing 9/11 issues. We're here to politely remind people, as George Carlin once said, let's not have a double standard here. One standard will do just fine. Cheers to George. In manipulating historical records as they unfold, censorship occurs at the moment of inception and continues to shape and frame public perceptions in ways that distract attention from cause and effect analysis of the events, often by concealing the power elite's motives and the role these play in political and economic matters. And in the introduction of our new book, Censored 2013, this issue of false consciousness is addressed by Nafis Mossadegh Ahmed, who refers to this again, and it's promoted as propaganda and maintenance of the powerful, and he has written several books on that, including The War on Truth and The War on Freedom. Many of you are probably aware of Nafis's work, and if not, I would urge you to look at them. I'd like to close by using a couple examples that discuss this narrative perception of history, by pointing out what's now at the front page of ProjectCensored.org, a study that I did with Laurel Krauss, who is, some of you may recognize her name, the sister of her slain sister, Allison Krauss, at the Kent State shootings, the Kent State massacre of May 1970. And the reason I bring this article up, it's part of our 2013 censored book, but this is a classic example of how we're working to uncensor the unhistories of our culture. Because the protesters at Kent State University and the people that were shot, 4 killed, 9 wounded, were murdered by the state. And I don't mean that glibly. I mean that new evidence that has been shown by forensic experts and even championed by Dennis Kucinich in Congress and then sent to the Department of Justice, which after a year of ignoring these calls for a new investigation on the Kent State shootings, ignored all the new evidence, recited the old evidence, and said there wasn't any cause to open a new case, even though it's been shown that FBI provocateurs working as part of the COINTEL program were there firing shots. They were the shots that allegedly were claimed to be sniper shots, and there are audio voice footage that has been decoded that is someone giving an order for the National Guard to actually fire on unarmed people at the Kent State campus. And the reason that that's poignant isn't just because of the radical injustices that these people have endured for 4 decades. It's because we see the same things happening today with the Occupy movement. We see the same repeated demonization of dissidents and protesters and radical justifications by the state for violence. I know Ann Coulter is an extreme example, but she has cited Kent State as a warning to Occupy, saying that we should kill more of these people, essentially, so that they go away. Now, that's pretty radical, and the state does operate in radical ways at times. But there are also other means by which, throughout history, that the state has operated to condemn, unpopularize, or dissuade people from investigating factual evidence. And through the 1960s, on the run-up to the Kent State shootings, the Central Intelligence Agency helped develop and draft memos that coined the term conspiracy theorist to label Edward J. Epstein about his critiques of the Warren Commission report and the J.F. Kennedy assassination, where they urged people in the media through their Operation Mockingbird programs, as they played their mighty Wurlitzer, to twist, distort, attack anyone that would suggest there were problems with this official narrative of JFK. They did the same types of things with the Kent State shootings. They've done the same things with October Surprise. They've done the same things with the Oklahoma City bombings. They've done the same things with 9/11. They've done the same things with WMD. They've done the same things with election fraud. They've done the same things. Does this get repetitive yet? Is there a pattern afoot? I would submit to you, again, back to our issues of language, that we really need to think about how we say what we say. We need to very clearly focus on the machinations of power in our society and how they help mold, control, and suppress freedom, specifically through dissent of those who wish to seek the truth about what really goes on in their society so they can make the world the beautiful place that it really can be. As Aldous Huxley once wrote, the facts do not cease to exist simply because they are ignored. And we're here to unignore them. With that, I would like to introduce to you the next speaker who will be talking a lot about the people I was talking around, the transnational corporate class, the ruling 1%. I would like to introduce to you the author of 16 books, towering figure of activism, and someone that really is energized with the human spirit, and someone that is also a dear, dear friend of mine, Dr. Peter Phillips.
Well, we certainly, Media Freedom Foundation, certainly hit a home run when we asked Mickey Huff to be director of Project Censored, and he accepted 2 years ago. And his doing that has allowed me to get back to some of my original interests and research, and that's the power elite. And I'm particularly interested in the transnational ruling class and their crimes against democracy. And this fits right into why we're all here today. And I want to address the world's 1% power elite and to what extent they operate in unison for their private gains over the benefits of the rest of us. And are they capable of committing state crimes against democracy? The Occupied movement has developed a mantra that addresses the great inequality of wealth and power between the world's wealthiest 1% and the rest of us, the other 99. Foremost among the early works on the idea of interconnected 1% in global capitalism was Leslie Sklar's work in 2001, The Transnational Capitalist Class. Sklar believed that globalization was moving transnational corporations into broader international roles, whereby these corporations' states of origin became less important than international agreements developed through the World Trade Organization and other international institutions. Emerging from these multinational corporations is a transnational capitalist class whose loyalties and interests, while still rooted in their corporations, are increasingly international in scope. Estimates are the total world's wealth is worth close to $200 trillion. With the U.S. and Europe holding approximately 63% of this wealth. An adult requires around $600,000 to be a member of the top 1%. That's $600,000 in assets. As of 2010, the top 1% of the wealthiest people in the world had hidden away between $21 to $32 trillion in secret tax-exempt bank accounts spread all over the world. This was a recent BBC report last month. The wealthiest 1% of the world's population represent approximately 40 million adults. These 40 million people are the richest segment of the first tier populations in the core countries and intermittently in other regions throughout the world. Most of this 1% has professional jobs with security and tenure working for or associated with established institutions. Approximately 10 million individuals of this 1% have assets in excess of $1 million. And approximately 100,000 have financial assets worth over $30 million, and it's about 1,000 or so that are billionaires. Now, immediately below this 1%, in the first tier, are working people with regular employment in various corporations, governments, self-owned businesses, and institutions all over the world. This first tier of working people constitutes 30-40% of the industrialized countries and about 30-20% in the underdeveloped countries. Throughout the world, there is a second tier of global workers representing growing armies of casual labor. These are the global factory workers, street workers, day laborers who are intermittently employed with increasingly less support from government and social welfare organizations. These workers, mostly constituted in the mega cities, make up 30-40% of the workers in industrialized countries, including the U.S., and some 20% in the peripheral countries. This leaves a third tier of destitute people worldwide, ranging from 30% in the core to fully 50% in the rest of the world, who have extremely limited income opportunities and struggle to survive on just a few dollars a day. These are 2.5 billion people who live on less than $2 a day. They die by the tens of thousands every day from malnutrition, easily curable diseases, and most have probably never even heard a dial tone. The number of unnecessary deaths has exceeded 300 million people in the last 40 years. Farmers grow enough food, we just don't distribute it well. So addressing the power of the global 1%, those in charge of food distribution, those in charge of governments, and identifying who they are, what their goals are really life and death questions. Now, it's important to understand how wealth is created and how it becomes concentrated. Historically, wealth has been captured, stolen, and concentrated by conquest by various powerful entities. One need only look at Spain's appropriation of the wealth of the Aztec and Inca empires in the early 16th century for a historical example of this process. The histories of the Roman and British empires are also filled with examples of wealth stolen. Once acquired, wealth can be used to establish means of production, establish cities, and build permanent institutions. But the means of production, like the early British cotton mills, were exploiting workers' labor power to produce goods whose exchange value was greater than the cost of labor. This process was analyzed by Karl Marx in Kapital. A human being is able to produce a product that has a certain value, and organized business hires the workers who are paid below the value of their labor. The result is the creation of what Marx called surplus value, over and above the cost of labor. The creation of surplus value allows those who own the means of production to concentrate capital even more. In addition, concentrated capital accelerates the exploitation of natural resources by private entrepreneurs, by mining and oil companies, whereby the value of the extracted resources far exceeds the cost of removal. It is through exploitation of natural resources that wealth is concentrated even further. This is a transfer of the common heritage of all living beings, the world mineral resources, to the coffers of the global 1%. So what happens to all this surplus money? Today, many firms operate primarily as investment organizations, managing capital and investing in other companies. These firms often do not actually make anything except money, and they are keen to prevent interference with return on capital by taxation, regulations, governmental interventions anywhere in the world. That's what they see it. They want no government interference. They want the free flow of capital worldwide. Now, a 2011 study at the University of Zurich, researched by three researchers there at the Swiss Federal Institute, reports that a small group of companies, mainly banks, wield huge power in the global economy. The study looked at all 43,000 transnational corporations and the web of ownership between them. The research created a map of 1,300 companies at the heart of the global economy. The study found that the 143 companies formed a super entity within this map, controlling some 40% of the world's wealth. The top 25 of these super entities are mostly banks and investment firms. So these are some examples, and this is when we start talking about the 1%, the kind of education that we all need. Number two in this list is Capital Group Companies, privately held, based in Los Angeles, manages $1 trillion in assets. Number three is FMR, one of the world's largest mutual funds, managing $1.5 trillion in assets, serving more than 20 million individuals. Number four is AXA, manages $1.5 trillion in assets, serving 101 million clients. Number five is State Street Corporation out of Boston, with assets in management of $1.9 trillion. Number six is J.P. Morgan, 2011 assets, $2.3 trillion. Their board of directors sits on Boeing, NBC, Universal, Comcast, Honeywell, Exxon. Next is Vanguard, number seven, assets $1.3 trillion. Then there's USB, AIG, assets $620 billion. Number nine is Merrill Lynch, assets of $2.3 trillion. Their directors sit on Bank of America, New York Stock Exchange, Credit Suisse, MetLife, Citibank, USB, Carlyle, Verizon, Fluor, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs. These are networks of power, people who know each other on the corporate boards of the world. Now, the number one most connected corporation in the world is Barclays. Members of the board of Barclays are on the boards of Abis, the South African banking company, Visa in Europe, British Broadcasting, Price Waterhouse Coopers, U.S. Banking, Audit Practice, Price Waterhouse, Morgan Stanley, ILA, the Italian Energy Group, Telecom Italia, Fidelity International, Rockefeller Group, Goldman Sachs, Bank of England, S.B. Miller, Barrett Gold, McGraw-Hill, and Schweppes. Now, that's just one bank. Now, tied closely to Barclays is the largest assets management firm in the world. It's called BlackRock, Inc., and it has over 10,000 employees based in New York, investment teams in 27 countries. Their clients include corporate, public, unions, pension funds, government, insurance companies, third-party mutuals, endowments, foundations. They go on and on. BlackRock controls $3.68 trillion in equity funds. That's a massive amount of money. BlackRock is one of the most concentrated power networks in the global 1%. The 18 members of the board of directors are connected to a significant part of the world's core financial assets. Their decisions can change empires, destroy currencies, impoverish millions. Some of the top financial giants of the world are connected by interlocking boards of directors at BlackRock, including Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, PNC Bank, Barclays, Swiss Reinsurance, American AIG, Arab Fund for Economic Development, Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley. That's in a concentrated, the most wealthy company in the world. BlackRock alone, their board has links to seven of the top 25 most interconnected corporations in the Swiss study. BlackRock's 18 board members control and influence tens of trillions of dollars of wealth in the world and represent a core of the super-connected financial elite. What's interesting for our purposes is we know that Barclays was a key insider in the Libor scandal, whereby traders and banks worldwide colluded to manipulate the Libor interest rates covering 10 global currencies in 2008, costing pension funds and other investors hundreds of billions of dollars. This was outright theft. The government is suing Barclays for $126 million, but nobody's going to jail over this. Corporate elites are interconnected through direct board connections with major multinational corporations, policy groups, media organizations, and other academic and nonprofit institutions. These interlock relationships reoccur across the top interconnected companies and in a powerful network who share interest in preserving their elite domination, and they are generally immune from criminal prosecution. Now, if a transnational corporate board meets on a regular basis to encourage the maximization of profit and the long-term viability of the firm's business plans, if they arrange for payments to government officials, conduct activities that undermine labor organizations, seek to manipulate the price of commodities and gold, engage in insider trading, they are in fact forming conspiratorial alliances inside these board of director rooms. Crimes are committed every day in these boardrooms around the world. Now, even deeper inside this 1% is what David Rykoff calls a superclass. Rykoff was the former managing director of Kissinger Associates, says that the superclass constitutes about 1/1,000th of 1% of the world's population, comprising 6,000 to 7,000 people. These are the Davos-attending, Gulfstream, private jet-flying, money-encrusted, mega-corporation, interlocked, policy-planning elites of the world. People who at the absolute peak of power, they are 99% male, predominantly white, mostly from North America and Europe, and they're the people setting the agendas of the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, and meet at Davos, the G8, the G20, NATO, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization. They run these places. The billionaires in the global 1% are similar to colonial plantation owners. They know they are a small minority with vast resources and power, yet they must continually worry about the unruly exploited masses rising in rebellion. As a result, the class insecurities, the superclass works to protect the structure of concentrated wealth. Protection of capital is the prime reason that NATO now accounts for 85% of the world's defense spending, and the U.S. spending more on military than the rest of the world combined. Would world elites commit SCADs, state crimes against democracy? Absolutely. Their private and public police forces do it every day. It's not just who that was directly behind 9/11 or who killed Kennedy. It is a recognition that when power lies in the world and the absolute control of power allows the transnational corporate class to dominate and set the agendas. NATO is quickly becoming the police force of the transnational corporate class. It has become clear that superclass uses NATO for global security. This is part of an expanding strategy of the U.S.-NATO domination of the world, whereby the U.S.-NATO military-industrial media empire operates in service to the transnational corporate class for the protection of international capital everywhere in the world. So it's a world of financial institutions run amok, where the answer to bankruptcy is to print more money through quantitative easing, with trillions of new inflation-producing dollars. It's a world of permanent war, whereby spending for destruction requires more spending to rebuild, a cycle that profits the transnational corporations and the global networks of economic power. It is a world of drone killings, extrajudicial assassinations, death, and destruction at home and abroad. Occupy and other truth-telling movements like 9/11 are exactly what the superclass fears the most. Global economic movements that expose their agenda. So everybody, let's keep it up. We have a world to win.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.